Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with Andrew Curran about his new book, Diderot and the Art of Thinking Freely. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
Well, thank you for joining us today. I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, let's see. I was born on Long Island. I didn't really know Long Island very well, and then went off to Queens, and then I really spent the most of my life in upstate New York in Glens Falls, which is above Saratoga. And I grew up there, went to Hamilton College, which is also in New York State. This is in the early 80s when New York City was terrifying to me. And then went off to Paris for a number of years, and then came back to New York City where I did my PhD at NYU. I had a teaching gig at Union College for a couple of years, and I've been at Wesleyan since 1998, Wesleyan University in Connecticut. And during that time, I've been working on a lot of different things. My first book was on history of medicine and the question of monstrosity. And then my second project was on the history of race. It's a big sweeping history of race in the 18th century. And this most recent project, the Diderot book, is entirely different. That's a biography, as you obviously know. And that's a different kind of project. But I teach language classes and literature classes and history of ideas classes here at Wesleyan. It's a great place.
That's a great range of subjects. And it's one that gives you a great skill set considering how diverse of a writer and a thinker that Diderot himself was. What was it that led you to take on Diderot as a biographical subject?
Let's see. I think there's actually an anecdotal explanation. I had written a piece for the New York Times about Diderot's 300th birthday in 2013. And right afterwards, I was contacted by the press for which I wrote this book. That's Other Press, which is an outfit from New York City, which has done some really great biographies. And I worked very closely with the editor of that press, Judith Gurwitch, for the entire four-year process during which I wrote the book. And I think it's pretty much how I got into Diderot. I mean, obviously, I know Diderot very well since I wrote my first book on Diderot. And it was a funny process for me because I'm, although trained in literature, I'm something of an intellectual historian, which is to say I love following big ideas as they move through time and they do different things and then have effects on people. And that's kind of a discourse view of history. And so, getting into the nitty gritty of a life with, people's infidelities, their nitpicking, their petty rivalries and things like that was an entirely different kind of situation. People emote in biographies, and I had to get used to that.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us something about Diderot, because he has this very interesting span in his life. And he, as you've already alluded to, he has these, he gets married, he has his affairs, and yet it's not something that you would have expected for him considering where he began. What was his early life like?
Yeah, I think to understand Diderot, you have to go back to the town in which he was born, and that is a small town in Burgundy called Langres, which is spelled L-A-N-G-R-E-S. It's a place of amazing cheese. It's a funny little Game of Thrones type city that sits on top of, you know, a sheared off volcano. It's about a mile square. For people who live near New York, it's about the size of Hoboken. And it is a citadel-like city. It's a wonderful ramparts and very, very isolated from kind of the rest of the world in many ways. It's a great place to visit, incidentally, and very interesting to kind of walk around and you can see for miles from the ramparts. You can walk around the city the whole way around. And so he grew up in this little town. His father was a cutler, a bourgeois cutler, and his mother came from a family of tanners. But many people in his family went into the church. So his sister became a nun. His younger brother became a very dogmatic, conservative priest, and ultimately became a deacon and then worked for the cathedral in Lang for a long time. An archdeacon, actually, he was. And so Diderot initially was on the same path. He was the oldest child in the family. He was on the same path, was preparing for the priesthood very early. He was tonsured, which to say his head was shaved. He became an abbot. He was a brilliant student at that time, something of a troublemaker. He used to get kicked out of school, even though he was the smartest kid essentially in the school, winning all the prizes. And about age 13, he goes off to Paris to study, which is rare at the time. He'd studied in the Jesuit college, which is to say the Jesuit kind of middle school, our equivalent in Lang. Goes off to Paris, where he studies at a place called the Collège d'Harcourt, which is a hard court college, which is gone now, but it's very close to the Boulevard Saint-Michel in Paris, which was kind of wiped out his school pretty much. Anyway, after that, he goes to the Sorbonne, which was the Faculty of Theology within the University of Paris. And at that time, he comes under the spell of the Parisian freethinkers. He is contaminated by the ideas of Voltaire in particular, I think, about kind of the new science coming from England. And basically, his kind of dogmatic religious understanding of the universe starts falling apart in his 20s. And he drops out of the Sorbonne. He becomes a ne'er-do-well, and he starts his life as a translator to kind of piece together a meager existence, becomes estranged from his family. And so what we have here is a story of somebody who starts off in a very traditional conservative family in a very traditional conservative small city in Paris, in Burgundy, goes to Paris, and falls under the influence of free thinkers, etc., and then becomes ultimately the most famous atheist of his era.
It's a very interesting intellectual path that he takes in his early years. But I was also struck when you describe the more mundane personal aspects of it, like how, for example, the degree to which his course was shaped by the death of, correct me if I'm wrong here, I believe it was his uncle. Initially, he had this career path charted out in the church. And then when this relative of his died and that closed off that career path, that contributed to that shifting of him. And it struck me about how interesting it was that insight that it gives us into some of the dynamics of French society at the time, about how, the possibilities of what was available and how the choices he had to make. Because that same dynamic plays a role when you're talking about those his early years as a writer and translator, when he's struggling to make a living, he's dealing with the expectations of his parents, and he's dealing with the opportunities and limitations that were available to him. It spoke to me, I thought, as to how dramatic his shift was, not just intellectually, but he goes out and breaks away from what would have been a very comfortable existence in the church to taking on this very challenging life as a writer and translator at a time when most people who wrote didn't necessarily make a good living off of it.
Yeah, let me start with the great story you allude to, which is kind of fun, and it's so emblematic of who he is. So his uncle, as you point out, is a chanoine. He's a canon in the cathedral in Lang, which is a big and powerful ecclesiastical kind of organization in Lang, huge, huge influence, so very rich at the time. And so his uncle says, I'm going to make my nephew into a canon as well. He's so brilliant. He's doing well at school, etc. And so he is setting this whole thing up. And this is really a nepotistic kind of succession plan. It doesn't work out very well. The people in the chapter, which is the organization of the canons in the cathedral, vote against this. And the uncle gets mad. He actually writes to the Pope. And while the letter is making its way to the Vatican, he dies. The uncle dies. And therefore, his request is null and void. And so this funny little contingency, this little tiny blip in Diderot's life changes everything, because at that point, he's not made canon. And Diderot says, well, I'm going to go to Paris. And so there is somebody who writes about this later on. One of the priests from Langres writes that, gosh, had that letter gotten to the Vatican, Diderot might not have been a great priest, but he never would have become an unbeliever. And that's probably not true. He probably would have still been an unbeliever, but he would have been one of those kind of agnostic priests who kind of made their life, tending the garden, perhaps, doing some scientific experiments. Diderot once said that might have happened to him had things worked out a little differently. And it's true, Diderot really often talked about the funny contingencies in his life, these little blips, these little kind of almost atom-like things that are bouncing together and changed his life a lot. When he gets to Paris, he has all these little odd jobs. You know, he's working, doing little translations. He's writing sermons for people. He is a tutor. He's tutoring in mathematics without really knowing mathematics that well, but he teaches himself that because he's so brilliant. And eventually just kind of admits, like, really, I don't want to do anything. I just want to study. And he teaches himself Italian. He teaches himself English. He teaches himself English by using a Latin English dictionary, which is amazing because he was such a great classicist. And then that is that funny little thing that he does that allows him to begin a career as a translator in Rue La Harpe, working for a number of translators and a number of editors who will later become the editors of the encyclopedia. So it's a life that of a ne'er-do-well. It's a life of a kind of a brilliant man who doesn't have a literary patron. At this time, many people might have patrons, and Diderot was one of the first, a member of the generation of people that did not have literary patrons. He was making it on his own.
Working as a translator, I think, is something that is often very unappreciated. And you mentioned the works that he translated, and they really speak to this fascinating gamut of knowledge that he had to possess. You have to think about, when I think about it in terms of, he has to know French and in the language he was translating, English. But the works he translates are so varied. It's Stanion's History of Greece. It's a medical dictionary. It's a philosophical work. And the amount of vocabulary that he had to know in both languages to engage in, I mean, we're not talking about simply translating works of fiction here, in which he's just using a general vocabulary. He has to know the specialized knowledge in order to make sure that his translations are accurate.
Yeah, I think this is really the first school for becoming an encyclopedist, isn't it? I mean, he is coming to grips with a lot of different kinds of knowledge in a lot of different areas, as you said, medical, philosophical, and historical. And for the kind of work he's going to be doing later on as the both contributor to the encyclopedia and the editor, this is really a great opportunity for him. I think the most important of those three works you're talking about is by Shaftesbury, the Earl of Shaftesbury. And this is a work of deism, and it's a kind of key thing to think about in Diderot's career, because Shaftesbury is a deist, as I said. And by deist, I mean somebody who believes in spiritual causality, who believes in God, who believes in a supreme being, but who has no need for Christian dogma and scripture. The argument from design, the teleological argument for God's existence, is the foundational idea behind deism. And Diderot is fascinated by this. It gives him an opportunity to grapple with some of the inconsistencies of Catholicism and Christianity in general, and in a way that doesn't yet reject the existence of God. That's a big, big step in the 18th century. He's not an atheist from birth, as some people like to point out. It's a slow and plodding process. And translation, as you point out, becomes an interesting way for him to kind of think through some of his early ideas before he really takes up the pen as a writer himself.
Was it the experience of translating Shaftesbury's inquiry into French what compelled him to start writing on his own, or were there seeds of that prior to his decision to tackle that work?
I think that was a different kind of translation in contrast to the Grecian history or the medicinal dictionary. Shaftesbury was an opportunity for him to become a writer, I think. He said that, you know, I translated Shaftesbury, but I essentially took up the pen after he put the book down, which to say that it was a somewhat free-flowing translation. And it was, to a large degree. He was dialoguing with different parts of Shaftesbury's characteristics, which is the larger work. And he also has these kind of funky footnotes, kind of a la David Foster Wallace, where he would just kind of go off on various subjects. And, you know, some of the most interesting parts of the book are when he really enters into dialogue with Shaftesbury. Deism was still a very heretical idea. This book was published anonymously. It was, seen as a part of a slippery slope into atheism by many people in the church. It was a very seen as a threatening idea. Free thinkers were thinking about deism as well as atheism.
You actually bring up a good point that we should probably address, given that it plays a very large role later on, and that's the role of censorship in France during this time. You get into it as early as the translations, but of course it plays a very large role when we're talking about the encyclopedia later on. Could you explain a bit how the challenges that writers faced in publishing in France during this time and some of the ways that they tried to get around those restrictions?
Yeah. When we think about censorship these days, we have an idea of people clamping down on free speech, et cetera. But really think about censor almost as a kind of a physical or intellectual process, a sifting of ideas so only the ones which are pure get through. And that's the kind of ideally kind of censored world. And people often thought, even Diderot and his friends thought that censorship was kind of a good thing in some ways. It kept bad ideas from being published. And although Diderot was a huge advocate for freedom of the press in many ways, particularly as he gets older, there are times where he thinks that the censor, which is a person, has a role in tamping down bad ideas that are circulating.
Now, if I may, it sounds like the role that some people assign to the editor today in an era where you have open publishing, you have independent publishing. And there's the sense that if you only had an editor there to, kind of filter through some of the bad ideas, we'd have better works. It sounds like that was the concept that they fixed upon the censors back in the 18th century.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Censorship, first you need to get it. Like, if you've got a book, Mark, if you're going to kind of publish a book, you want to put your name on that book in France in 1749, you need to have royal approval, which to say that you need to actually have the approval of the censor. But there's a lot of other people involved in censorship, and these are kind of moral authorities in addition to the actual administrative authorities. So if the censor and the kind of the director of the book trade works under and with the chief of police in Paris, who works for the king. There are also, there's the Sorbonne, as I said, the theologians of the Sorbonne. There's the Parliament, which is not a representative body at all, but it's a kind of a hereditary body that is set up of essentially magistrates who look over the very, very, very kind of a Jansenist-leaning group. And there's the Jesuits. There's a lot of people who will chime in about the suitability of various works. And they gang up on works which are polemical. It's quite interesting to note that, the book trade was something of had the kind of privileged status of Silicon Valley, maybe in the 18th century, that it was a huge moneymaker for a lot of people. And the Crown didn't want to stamp, stop books from coming out, even books that were somewhat polemical, because they had a huge economic value, and they didn't want to drive books into Holland, which gets to the second part of your question. The best way to publish a polemical book, a book that might challenge either religion or, less likely, but sometimes the royal authority, would be to publish it in Holland. Holland had an enormous publishing industry, and books would come back into France, packed in, straw or in barrels, etc., and it would be sold. There would be less control, no taxes, no royal privileges, etc., and you could use different names. One of the favorite ploys of D'Holbach, one of Diderot's friends, was to find out who had died recently and put the name of that person on a book in Holland and then bring it back. And so there was no problem. So there were a lot of ways around censorship, but it was very hard for Diderot because, he was had been arrested. And I bet you're going to ask me about that. But he was arrested. And after he got out of jail, it was very difficult for him. Paris was kind of like, as somebody once put this to me, it was kind of like Soviet Moscow combined with the Tehran and during the time when of great kind of metaphysical kind of policing. So Diderot was spied upon as soon as he got out of jail. It was very difficult for him to publish, and so he had to do a number of other sneaky things, and he didn't publish like D'Holbach did. This is the Baron D'Holbach, 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 who would send his manuscripts off to be published abroad and then come back.
You alluded to the fact that Diderot was indeed in prison for a period of time. What was it that led to his imprisonment, and did that imprisonment have any sort of impact upon his life or his career?
We have to kind of go back to 1749, and this is a funny year in French history. It was a year after a very unsuccessful military campaign where France gave away some land that it had actually won in a battle, but, gave back. People were unhappy. There were a lot of militant poets, which is such a funny notion, that were active at this time. The king was under siege. There were all sorts of rumors that the king was kidnapping children and using their blood to bathe in to stay young. There was all sorts of strange things going around. And so there was a crackdown going on at that time. And this is the time when Diderot chooses to publish his book, The Letter on the Blind. Now, The Letter on the Blind itself is a very interesting philosophical text, which is kind of tough to read if you were to buy it at a bookstore. But it's fascinating in that it has this great scene where a blind man is dying, and he essentially refutes the existence of God in three or four different very powerful ways as he's dreaming and dying. And this is really the moment where Diderot clearly is switching over to an atheistic as opposed to a deistic view of the world. And this alone would have gotten him in trouble, but he makes fun of somebody in the beginning of the book, and that's what started the whole problem. He made fun of somebody who was a prominent aristocrat, and she wrote the chancellor, essentially, somebody on the equivalent of the chancellor, and this person says, we need to round up the usual suspects during this time of great upheaval, and Diderot was at the wrong place at the wrong time. So I think he was not arrested for the letter on the blind, but of course, once he's in jail, they're reading this stuff, they understand that he had written that, and they knew from a police file that had been keeping on him that he had written this something called the Philosophical Thoughts, and a libertine novel called The Indiscreet Jewels as well, which is something of a prototype of the Vagina Monologues. And that this is a court set in Africa where women's genitalia are telling their tales. And, Diderot was very embarrassed. He didn't put his name on any of these books, but he's particularly embarrassed about that book. And so they held him for 3 months in a prison in Vincennes, which is in the east of just outside of Paris to the east. And know, this really, you know, changes his life. It's the kind of the fulcrum point. Interestingly enough, he lived for 71 years and he went to jail really at the exact half point, the midpoint in his existence. And you can really divide up his life that way. It's hugely significant.
It's interesting as well, because you explain how it tempers his writing in some respects, that he doesn't change his thoughts necessarily. It's not as though he recants, but he realizes that after he leaves, that he has to express himself more carefully. And you tie this into the project of the encyclopedia. I was wondering if you could start us off by talking about what was the encyclopedia, how did it begin, and at what point does Diderot become involved with it?
Yeah, the encyclopedia starts off like many projects with you know, a little kind of funny story, that there's a funny German guy who approaches this printer named Le Breton, like Le Breton, and asks him if he might be interested in translating an English dictionary, which was very popular at the time, Chambers' Cyclopedia, not encyclopedia or encyclopedia, but cyclopedia. And Diderot at this time is, just a translator, and he's brought on very early as somebody to help out with the articles and do some editing. This guy gets fired from the encyclopedia. They hire a second, much more prominent French editor. He gets fired. And finally, after 2 or 3 years, Diderot and his friend D'Alembert are hired. And so he becomes the editor of the encyclopedia in the late 1740s, right before he goes to jail. And one of the reasons that people say he should get out of jail is because they want him to take care of the encyclopedia. When he gets rapped on the knuckles, he is seen as this unrepentant atheist in many ways by many people, but he still has this hugely powerful or important project, which is synonymous with kind of French knowledge and science and so on and so forth. And so the people do want him to finish that project. And so he, the first volume comes out in 1751, and he finishes the project in 1773. There are 17 volumes of text, 72 or 73,000 articles. There are another 11 folio size books filled with incredibly beautiful illustrations, 11 volumes, as I said. So it's a 28 volume, enormous project, life sucking endeavor, which lasts about 20, 25 years and goes through all sorts of problems. It's a kind of a great story. And to get back to the question of censorship, which is where you started. Now, censorship here makes the encyclopedia. If people are allowed to say whatever they want, it gets boring, I think. And the fact that there are all these constraints created the genius of the encyclopedia, where Diderot had to hide his thoughts and hide what he really thought, because he was could easily be locked up, and not for months, but for decades. So there are these great feints. There's all sorts of kind of irony and satire inside the encyclopedia. There's, you know, fabulous and funny cross-referencing. He's really the father of hyperlinks. And that's really what's going on in the encyclopedia in many instances. Funny cross-references to things that don't make sense, or you have a very stodgy, straightforward article, and then you refer it to something which contradicts the fundamental essence of what you are talking about. So if you are talking about an ecclesiastical subject, then the cross-reference might be to intolerance, where you get you understand that what's being said in the initial article is implicitly being refuted by what comes later. And people pored over this. It was such a kind of a crossword puzzle type experience, where you're looking for clues and things.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini,
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's a very, it's a work, of course, that doesn't just involve Diderot's efforts and writings, but it incorporates a very wide swath of some of the leading lights of the French Enlightenment. And this gets to an interesting question that you do illuminate in your book, which is, what is Diderot's place in the Enlightenment, and what are his relationships with the other major thinkers of the era?
Well, that's a big question. Well, yeah, so let's start with first the Encyclopedia Project itself. It was, you know, seen, I think it's important to point out, and your question really underscores this, that the Encyclopedia Project was seen as a collective endeavor. If philosophy, and particularly challenging and polemical philosophy, you know, circulated before the 1750s, generally, you know, it was packaged in small, easy to transfer books that you could hide under your jacket, et cetera. And one of the major changes in this book, and there are some big, you know, books like this before, like Bale's Dictionary as well, but the encyclopedia trumpets the ideology of encyclopedism. And this is an emancipatory understanding of philosophy, the power of philosophy to free people from their own prejudices. It's a gigantic cudgel. People have called it a machine de guerre. It's, you know, sometimes pretty tepid compared to some other books that, you know, say, Dolbach writes. But it really is this, it has a particular, you know, stature, this giant, beautiful luxury edition. It really brought free thinking and, as I said, an ideology of emancipation into public in a way that had not been done before. Everybody read this book because they knew that the major, as you said, leading lights were participating. Buffon, the great naturalist, did not participate, but Daubenton did. Voltaire was writing for it initially. Rousseau as well, Diderot's friend Rousseau, was also writing for it. He wrote about 300 articles on music. So it was a collective endeavor by what they called a Société des gens de lettres, a society of men of letters. So it was this idea of a collective endeavor of really the century's most brilliant people coming together. And it had an enormous kind of cultural capital. It people like Catherine the Great subscribed to it. And there were 4,300, I think, subscribers to this ultimately. And then, of course, there were many, many more editions. I think that Robert Darton, the great historian, estimates that there were 25,000 copies circulating by the end of the century. So there was a lot of clout behind the encyclopedia, and Diderot started off a relatively unknown, a person who had written these kind of atheistic books when he starts, but he becomes the public figure of the encyclopedia. D'Alembert, his co-editor, was far more famous initially. He really is a kind of almost Newton level genius in terms of mathematics. And D'Alembert drops out, and Diderot is the one who finishes this entire project and becomes, as I said, synonymous with the encyclopedia. In fact, it's one of the reasons his legacy is so hard to pin down is that he is often reduced to this vulgarizer of the era's knowledge. He's the person who made the encyclopedia and not much more. That's what's his reputation in the 18th century among many people.
I took it as something of a testament to the stature that he gains from the encyclopedia when he becomes one of the figures in the satirical play that comes out in the 1760s. And I thought it was a very interesting look at how at both how the era viewed Diderot as a result of the Encyclopedia, and also it gave, as you describe his response to it, it gives you a really good look at the man as not this great thinker, but as a human being with his own vulnerabilities and sensitivities.
Yeah, the play you're referring to is Palissot's Les Philosophes. And the context for this play, which was an incredibly successful and satirical play, is that late 1750s and early 1760s, the Encyclopedia was either under siege or banned, and people ganged up on it in a way that people gang up on people on the internet these days. And the most effective way of doing so was not the internet, it was the stage for someone like Palissot. So he writes a satirical play that has a number of the kind of Enlightenment figureheads on stage. Palissot loved Voltaire, so he did not put Voltaire on stage, but he certainly made fun of Rousseau. Rousseau was not an Enlightenment figurehead at this point. He'd kind of pulled out of the Enlightenment project, if there was a project. But he makes fun of Rousseau, and he makes fun of Diderot. And Diderot is this plagiarist, kind of deceitful, kind of a disseminator of fake news, and really the leader of this gang of charlatans, these philosophes who are taking over and poisoning France. It really is kind of reminiscent of the way we talk about our own world right now. Rousseau's treatment is really much funnier. They had Rousseau, who is, of course, the partisan of the stereotype of the state of nature, the natural man, the noble savage, etc. They had Rousseau come out on stage, or the character representing Rousseau come out on stage on all fours and acting like an animal, and he pulls a cabbage out of his pocket and eats it. And during the 18th century, people didn't eat raw vegetables, so they reduced him to the state of animal. And it's a very funny play, which is kind of a Molière-like type play. It's all in verse, very clever. I think it actually would work out much better than Diderot's own plays, which are much more kind of solemn and, they just don't work out so well. Palissot's play is not a great play, but it's pretty darn funny in the context of kind of Enlightenment politics. And you're right, Mark, there's a lot of there's an interesting way of seeing Diderot's own preoccupations, insecurities, and anxieties being capitalized on or, pointed out by Palissot. Palissot had a really very sharp pen, and he really nailed Diderot in this play. Diderot hated this play. It was really one of the dark days of his whole life. Encyclopedia is under siege, having troubles at home. And of course, this play came out, and it was a huge success. And Diderot lived probably about half a mile from the Comédie Française, if that. And just to see people lined up to see the play for weeks on end must have been just brutal.
You mentioned that Diderot was a playwright himself, and this gets to this interesting question of his later plays, because he's not just doing the Encyclopedia, editing the Encyclopedia full time. He's also crafting his own literary works as well. And yet, as you describe, many of these works don't see the light of day in his own lifetime.
Yeah, if I could say two words about the way I set up the book, Diderot is a tough person to write about because he was not like Rousseau. Rousseau was so preoccupied with who he was as a person, and he spent a lot of time introspectively sorting through his own past and the confessions. And we have a kind of a great idea. It may not be totally truthful, but we have a really good idea of who Rousseau is. And there are other writers who leave behind a fantastic set of letters early in their life. And Diderot's early life is a desert. It's really tough to kind of figure out what's going on in his life. One thing we certainly do know is that after he gets out of prison, and of course the correspondence picks up pretty well at this point, but he gets out of prison, he realizes he can't write in the same way that he was writing before all these polemical works. And so he starts writing for the drawer, essentially, as the French like to say. So he writes for the drawer, and he figures out that he's going to target posterity. And this is why I set up the book in two different ways, where I have the first half of the book is somewhat biographical, when I'm moving through his life, piecing together his life at different stages, the Diderot growing up in Langres, Diderot at going to Paris and working through and dropping out of the Sorbonne, deciding not to be a priest, becoming a freethinker, a translator, a husband, and so on and so forth, and running the encyclopedia. And then, you know, the second half of the book I call Late Harvest, because Diderot really produces the greatest late harvest for us of the 18th century. So the second half becomes much more thematic. And thematic because I use his texts to I group his texts thematically in order to talk about the things he's left behind, because he left a large number of writings on unpublished writings on art history or art criticism, on what I'm calling kind of anachronistically kind of sexology. And his political writings, etc. And these were all discovered after he died. He created three caches of manuscripts, one of which went to his daughter, one of which went to Catherine the Great as well. So he's kind of making sure that after he dies, his works will appear and kind of explode like bombs in French literature. And that's exactly what Goethe said about him, that, you know, when Goethe discovers Rameau's Nephew, one of Diderot's books, he's just blown away by it and said, this is going to be a bomb within French literature. And Diderot was preparing for this. He was hoping to talk to posterity. He was hoping to talk to us. And that's why I called it Late Harvest, because, you know, we are the recipients of this. And I think it's really fun to think about him really creating a group of writings that was designed for a different generation in many ways.
He really is, in that respect, speaking it to the future in a way that that's very calculated. I mean, most people are definitely writing for the present. They're hoping they have that impact. But Diderot really is thinking about, you know, what is going to be, the world's going to be like once he's gone.
Yeah, I mean, he is so prescient in many ways. You know, he's thinking about, you know, different kind of political revolutions. He's thinking about natural history in a very prescient way. He's thinking about the future. He does predict a lot of things, but at the same time, in terms of history, he's not sure whether the world is moving in a progressive way or in a regressive way. He's pretty pessimistic, actually, for the latter part of his life. He thinks that there might be a kind of a terrible revolution and the sciences will kind of disappear. He thinks this encyclopedia might be a great repository of knowledge, which will help you know, humankind make progress after a dark era. So, you know, it's actually interesting that he is thinking about the future. He's not exactly who is going to be living in the future, but he's often talking about that. I mean, in terms of being prescient, if I could say a few words about that, that's pretty interesting. He's certainly chatting about, or certainly thinking about a lot of ideas which are very, very pertinent these days. He talks about the young United States in the late 1770s. He was an Americanist since the 1760s, had met with Benjamin Rush in his apartment. And he is looking at the United States as this fascinating experiment. You know, North America for him had both the dangers of slavery and just the horror of slavery, which he really loathed and wrote against quite vociferously and effectively. And it was also the place where there was these American colonies were creating the first democratic republic that in the 18th century that really fascinated him. And he took a few moments to write to the founding fathers and the people who had claimed their liberty and taken their liberty from the British in the late 1770s. And he writes to the so-called American insurgents and says, you know, don't worry about foreign powers. This is not going to be the problem for this small country. It is going to be your own wealth and success which will be your problem. You will perhaps have after many generations, you will have a class of super wealthy people, and you'll have a class that is not super wealthy. And if you're not careful, you may even have a tyrant. So it's a really interesting way to talk to the future about he's talking about politics, he's talking about art, he's talking about just about everything. And often he's talking to a select group of people. And then there's a second kind of audience, you know, there's a kind of a diachronic side to his writing where there's always kind of two temporalities. He's writing in the present, certainly for a small audience, and then he's always writing for us as well.
You mentioned that he left one of these caches with Catherine the Great. And as you explained, they have a very interesting relationship, one that was of incredible importance to Diderot in his later years. I was wondering if you could explain for us what that relationship was and how it led Diderot to do something that he was not really always very happy to do, which was travel.
Yeah. So yeah, Diderot was not a great traveler. I mean, Rousseau was a great traveler, and Voltaire got around quite a bit as well. He's, you know, most famously goes to London, then he goes to Frederick the Great's court as well, and then he goes to Ferney. He's moving around. Diderot pretty much hung out in Paris, made a couple trips to Langres, where he grew up. But it makes this great trip to see Catherine. Now, how would someone like Diderot get to know Catherine the Great? It's kind of a funny thing. They're separated by an enormous distance. But I think you have to remember that first, you know, Catherine is looking toward the capital, the cultural capital of Europe, as are all members of European royalty. The Paris was the epicenter of European culture and arts and letters and painting and so on and so forth. And Diderot and his buddy Melchior Grimm had created something called the Literary Correspondence, which was this manuscript-only newsletter, 15 copies or so that circulated around Europe. And inside it was kind of the, gossip, you know, literary musings, criticism on various plays and operas and so on and so forth. And one of the things inside this was Diderot's art criticism. So he went to the Salon, which is a biennial art exhibition taking place at the Louvre. In fact, the name Salon comes from, you know, if you talk about an art salon, it comes from this room in the Louvre called Le Salon. And every 2 years they would have this art show. All the artists belonging to the Royal Academy would hang their paintings, sometimes drying on the walls. And all of Paris was invited. And Diderot would write this up for various people, for this small group of princes and European royalty, including Catherine the Great after the 1760s. So this information would travel all around. And he also ended up working for Catherine in Paris. He made friends with the Russians. The Russians were trying to lure him to Paris. The Russians were trying to lure a number of French figureheads to Paris. They tried to hire D'Alembert. They tried to bring Diderot. They tried to bring Voltaire there. And Catherine is getting, maintaining an epistolary relationship with a lot of different people, including Grimm. Now, Diderot doesn't go to Russia initially, but he does start, corresponding kind of implicitly with her through this correspondence. And eventually he starts working for her after she does this amazingly generous thing. She buys his library when he is kind of fallen. He needed some money for a daughter's dowry. And as the encyclopedia is just about kind of petering out and the money he's getting from the encyclopedia is drying up, he gets an enormous infusion of cash from Catherine, who allows him to keep his library, and she makes him the kind of imperial librarian for his own library, and pays him 50 years in advance. So all of a sudden he has a lot of money thanks to her. And so he says, "Well, I will be your cultural ambassador, essentially, in Paris." And so he's going around buying paintings for her as she's putting together the Hermitage collection. It's pretty amazing. And he negotiates an enormous purchase of the second biggest collection of paintings and art in France. And this was really to the dismay of many people in France. But he didn't care. He thought that, you know, France had kind of turned its back on him in many ways. And so he does this and he sends this off. And this really becomes the foundation for the Hermitage collection, one of the main collections, you know, Rembrandt and lots of excellent canvases. So he's working for her, and eventually he gets to a point in his life in 1773. He's an old man at this time, where he feels very grateful to her, and at the same time he's kind of sad about life in Paris. And he makes the trip to see Catherine. And he's thinking about maybe doing a second encyclopedia, where he would not be beaten up in the same way he was beaten up in France doing the encyclopedia, where it was canceled and, you know, forbidden to publish it on two occasions. So he goes to see Catherine and perhaps set up the encyclopedia and also talk to her about reforming Russia. And so this is where we kind of enter into the political stage of Diderot's life. He gets to Russia, and before he goes there, he's preparing a lot of small essays on Russia. Catherine herself had thought about reforming certain things, and she had published a book to this effect. And when he gets there, he has these famous discussions with her. He goes over to her winter palace three times a week in the afternoons for tea. Very famously, he gets excited about many of his discussions as he's talking and reading his essays. He apparently bangs his hand on her leg, and then, you know, the next time he shows up, she has ordered that a table be put between their chairs, so he doesn't do that anymore.
Subtle.
Very subtle. And at the end of this, before he goes home, he's there for several months. He goes back. He's somewhat dismayed as well, because, you know, he said, you know, why aren't you taking my suggestions? And she says, well, you know, the problem, Denis, the problem, Monsieur Diderot, is that, you know, your ideas are great on paper, but I have to work on human skin. And he understands at this point that some of the ideas he's proposing in terms of creating a much more democratic and fair-minded empire. Certainly, he wasn't talking about making a full republic or a democracy or anything like that, but more representation for people and certainly treating the serfs better. He realizes this is not going to work out. And later on, although he promises he would never say anything bad about her during his lifetime, he certainly writes a lot about Russia in several kind of later political works, particularly a book called this book. It shows up in the History of the Two Indies and some other kind of political writings he's writing at the end of his lifetime. And here he really takes Catherine to task for being a tyrant, an enlightened despot, and saying that this is really, what she's doing here. She's setting herself up, setting the empire up for a great fall, because even if she is an enlightened despot, the people who succeed her may not be as fair-minded as she is. So, Diderot becomes much, much more political at the end of his life, and I think that his interaction with Catherine is the thing that pushed him in that direction. One of the things that I did, yeah.
You mentioned these writings. Were they also for the drawer, or did Catherine see them in her lifetime?
Yes and no, and yes. It's really funny because she saw them during her lifetime, but they were designed for the drawer, essentially. He did not publish them, particularly the things that targeted her directly. There were some oblique references to her in the History of the Two Indies, which was another book where he kind of wrote in the margins. It was not, this book did not have his name on the cover by any stretch of the imagination. But in these texts which were designed for her, where he wrote in the margins of the book that she had written, the Nakaz, she got these after he died, and I think he dies in 1784, but she gets them in 1785 when all these things finally show up in St. Petersburg, and she's absolutely livid to see many of the things he had written about the Russian Empire.
Yet, despite that, she, the fact that he did write these writings, she was very generous to him to the end of his life. You describe what happens in his last few months, where he's dying, and she, pays for this very nice apartment on the Rue Richelieu, in which he dies, and it gives a sense as to a person who, you know, he has this nice long life, and he is respected by some of the leading lights of his time. And yet you describe how in the immediate decades following, especially when you have the event of the French Revolution, how his He still remains in many ways very controversial among people who you would think would have been inspired and embraced a lot of the things that he wrote about.
Yeah, let me say one thing first about Catherine. I think you made a really good point here that he's, I think that she, he feels and she feels they're both members of this intellectual aristocracy. He certainly knew where he stood vis-a-vis Catherine the Great, Empress of all the Russias. He knew that quite well, but he did feel that, they had this very important bond, these incredible discussions. And even though she didn't budge on many things, he did admire her greatly throughout his life. And she gave him a cameo ring before he left St. Petersburg, and he apparently treasured that the rest of his life. And it's true that, to get back to the second part of your question where you're talking about his legacy, I think that's another very important topic. As he is moving, I can talk a little bit of what happens when he gets back from France. So he goes back to Holland for a while, and then he goes to France, and he gets there pretty much just as Louis XVI, the ill-fated Louis XVI, is taking over from his grandfather, Louis XV. And there's a time where Diderot feels like things are going to get better, but they don't get better. He thinks that the reformers, his friends like Turgot, have taken over and are going to usher in a new era in French politics. But after a few years, that kind of fizzles out, and he's dismayed. He's preparing his manuscripts for his for posterity, etc. And his reputation at this point is a little bit unsavory because he publishes an essay on Seneca, where he writes about Jean-Jacques Rousseau after his death. And here he kind of lambasts Rousseau as a kind of a lying cheat and a charlatan and a fraud, and really is taken to task by a lot of people for that. So his legacy, as he's dying, as in his last years, is as follows. He is the person who was the great vulgarizer, the head of the encyclopedia, the person who introduced a lot of ideas into France potentially very disruptive. He is somebody who ushered in the great secularization and desacralization of France. He had a really unsavory reputation among a lot of people as he dies, and he was not associated with any great work. He didn't have a social contract. He didn't have a Candide. He didn't have some of the books we now associate with the Enlightenment. And he dies. When the revolution happens 5 years after his death, you would think that perhaps he would be rehabilitated by the revolutionaries. But they were very smart and cagey, and they understood, Robespierre in particular, that associating their movement, this movement of liberation, which is perfectly consonant with the way that Diderot was thinking and writing, but associating their movement with atheism, with which Diderot was synonymous, would have killed it, or really, made it not work out as well for a lot of people. So Diderot was forgotten. The great heroes, the intellectual heroes of the revolution, are Rousseau and Voltaire, both of whom were pantheonized, put in the pantheon in the 1790s, where Diderot was essentially forgotten at that point. And he becomes, something of a contentious figure in the 19th century. By this point, some of the late harvest has begun, and his texts are trickling out. There's the text, The Nun, that trickles out, that is published. Rameau's Nephew is published, in the 19th century. D'Alembert's Dream, this great natural history, or this kind of almost science fiction type take on the origin of human species, comes out. There's a lot of things that are appearing. Jacques Le Fataliste, this book on determinism, is out. And all of a sudden, Diderot becomes much more pertinent because he's got these texts that people can read, and he becomes, again, a flashpoint between conservative France and more progressive France. His rehabilitation doesn't really take place until the 1870s or so. At this point, we move into a new Republican era. If you remember, in 19th century France is going back and forth between, restored monarchy, republic, and back and forth, et cetera. and various revolutions as well. So by the time that the Third Republic has taken root, the progressive thinkers, and we're talking about positivists, free thinkers, and atheists, and people who really are wed to the idea of progress and science and the desacralization of France, take up Diderot as their hero. And in many ways, in the 1870s, 1880s, he supplants Voltaire as the kind of most emblematic figure of the Enlightenment. Statues pop up in Rolandre. A statue pops up in two statues pop up in Paris. There's still one was melted down by the Germans, but the more famous one by Guterin is on the Boulevard Saint-Germain. And there's huge ceremonies and celebrations of who Diderot was by the positivists, and at the 3,000-4,000 people are gathering near Trocadero to celebrate Diderot's the anniversary of his death, etc. So it's an interesting time for Diderot, and after that he during this time he becomes really one of the cherished figures of the avant-garde. Freud and Marx, there are a lot of people who look to him as somebody who's really pushed the frontiers of knowledge and also helped people to think about some of the fundamental questions of what it is to be a human in a way that is not dogmatic, like many other people. His view of life is projected into a dialogical form in many of his works. And so the fact that he doesn't come up with a big, strong, dogmatic, monological truth is really synonymous with Diderot. And he seems so modern to us right now. He's tough to teach, I'll say that. I'm teaching a Diderot class right now. And undergraduates have a tough time moving through, four or five big Diderot books. But he really is an interesting and a great companion. In the same way that Montaigne can be a great companion at all points in your life, Diderot is certainly like that as well now.
I was, when you're describing the rehabilitation of his reputation, I couldn't help but think about the chapter in your book where you describe your visit to his hometown, and you describe all the streets that are named after him, and there's a motorcycle dealership named after him, and a coffee bean shop named after him. I'm thinking, is there really any better sign of the general acceptance of a person nowadays than the fact that the hometown just names everything after him, from the schools down to your cigarette shops?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I wish I had developed a little bit more. The juxtaposition of the legacy within geography, if I can put it that way, but the imagined geographies of writers are, and I think it's such a fascinating subject. And Long, certainly, as you said, there's the entire town, which is tiny. I think about 8,000 people live there, is just full of Diderot names. What I love that's so funny is you have the Diderot Middle School and the Diderot High School. So they kept them both. And in Paris, he really has kind of disappeared. Many of the buildings in which he lived have disappeared. His famous, his apartment on Rue Tarenne has disappeared. This is pretty much at the intersection of the Boulevard Saint-Michel and the Rue de Rennes in Paris. His street was razed during the Haussmann revolution of Paris in the 1860s. So, Diderot has kind of disappeared from the Paris landscape in many ways. I mean, there's just so many figures and ghosts are competing for space in Paris, whereas in Langres, he's everywhere. It's really a really interesting place to visit. If anyone wants to kind of get a good taste of Diderot, it's a fun place to be. There's a good restaurant called the Diderot Restaurant, and there is a great museum in his honor too.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I had two projects in my. I've got three things, and I'll be really brief here. For a while, I was thinking about working on Anthony Benezet and Olida Equiano on abolitionism and bringing these two abolitionist thinkers into kind of dialogue in a back and forth, a dual biography. Well, Ekweyanu is a Nigerian, an African who is an emancipated slave and writes his own autobiography. And Benezet is one of the most important abolitionists, probably the most important abolitionist in history, both in the United States and in England as well. He really kind of begins abolitionist thought. But these guys, I started reading about them. They're wonderful. They do great things, but they're so earnest. And they are so good that it's hard to find enough emotional kind of sloppiness as you find in Diderot's life that to make that part of the book interesting. It might be too triumphalist. And I was thinking about writing, you know, about academia a little bit, but I think probably I'm going to go back to the 18th century and write about Louis the 16th perhaps. So that whole era is so interesting. I think most people write about Louis the 16th and Marie Antoinette, and I might think about writing about that era from a different perspective, thinking about the relationship between Paris and Versailles, and not in Versailles Marie Antoinette and Louis the 16th. So we'll see. I'll keep you posted.
Please do. And hopefully when you have completed those works, we can have you back.
That'd be great.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much for taking some time from your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
And you too, Mark. Thanks so much.